Welcome to another edition of Oncology Today. This program focused on key presentations on CLL and lymphoma from the recent major oncology hematology conferences. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. For this program, I met with Dr. Jeremy Abramson from the Massachusetts General Hospital in Boston. In addition to this interview, there's also a corresponding video program featuring Dr. Abramson's slide presentation. To begin, I asked him about his preference for BTK inhibitors as first-line treatment of CLL.
I think it's hard to say. I do definitely believe the Alpine trial that there's an improvement in efficacy for zanubrutinib over ibrutinib, which along with the improved safety profile makes it a clear improved choice over ibrutinib. I think acalabrutinib is more unanswered. I'd certainly favor it over ibrutinib if I were choosing between the two, based on the fact that there's clearly a better safety profile for acalabrutinib. My generally preferred agent is zanubrutinib because it has shown superior efficacy and safety, but I think both are good agents in CLL.
Just out of curiosity, about when did you decide that zanu was going to be your favored first-line BTK?
I think it was really the Alpine trial that convinced me. There's also, you know, there is more favorable pharmacokinetic properties. It's the only BTK inhibitor that maintains above the IC90 for the entire dosing period. So there's potential rationale for why it might be a slightly better mousetrap in this circumstance. But I think the data is what speaks for it.
I'm just kind of curious, particularly the ibrutinib studies, when you start going out 5 and 6 years, like what fraction of the deaths are directly related to CLL as opposed to completely not related?
It's a good question. The majority are CLL related, and that includes patients who have a Richter's transformation.
Right.
Although the incidence of Richter's does appear to have gone down by treating patients more optimally upfront, but it's still CLL related deaths for the most part. And that can also include secondary malignancies, which are at increased risk among CLL patients, as well as infections.
Interesting. I keep hearing about the fact, supposed fact, I wonder if you agree with this or not, that a substantial number of patients in the United States are receiving first-line therapy with chemoimmunotherapy, BR. I've heard numbers like in the range of 25 or 30% from these sort of real-world studies. And often they don't really get into why. So first of all, I'm curious whether you believe that that's actually the case. You see a lot of second opinions of people who get first-line chemoimmunotherapy. And if it is the case, what do you think the reason is? Do you think it's primarily because the docs aren't up to date, or do you think it's maybe an issue about being able to access particularly oral expensive meds?
I think that's a big one. You know, it definitely still happens. I will say I see it less and less over time. So I do think that BR is being used a lot less in the upfront setting. I think there's a lot of, people who are practicing out there who have a lot of experience with BR, really like giving BR and like the fact that it's time-limited therapy. And particularly when it was either ibrutinib or BR, I think there were folks who didn't want the long-term ongoing toxicity profile of ibrutinib compared to the short-term impact of BR. I think over time, we have better BTK inhibitors, meaning zanubrutinib and acalabrutinib, and we also have time-limited therapy with venetoclax and obinutuzumab. So presently, I really see no major reason to give BR in the upfront setting, with one exception, and that is what you alluded to, Neil, which is insurance coverage for oral oncolytics. And there are still plenty of insurance plans out there with insufficient oral drug coverage. And this includes patients on Medicare who don't have Medicare Part D, whereby any of the oral oncolytics might cost them an arm and a leg. And when you're deciding between ibrutinib, zanubrutinib, acalabrutinib, and venetoclax, they're all going to be expensive without coverage for oral drugs. And so that, I think, is still the one area where it's, you know, reasonable to give those drugs. I don't think a patient should go bankrupt to receive these drugs. They remain an option in the relapse refractory setting. We now have good evidence that BTK inhibitors and venetoclax are superior therapy to bendamustine. And it would be my preference for them to receive that, one of the novel agents. But if they're going to have to pay out of pocket and it's going to bankrupt them and impair their quality of life from a fiscal perspective, then I think BR is still defensible in that context.
Although I guess you have to take into account that, if you get, venetoclax, you're going to have a bunch of time off treatment completely. So theoretically, you'd have to factor that in to mitigate the cost a little bit, but it's a very good. Yeah, that's what I assumed was the major reason at this point. I mean, there are people without insurance. You would think, 30% seems even, low when you think about this. I'm surprised it's not higher in a way.
I agree with you. I think that's the dominant issue. The other thing I'll point out is there's still a certain amount of hesitancy out there to, with venetoclax-based therapy upfront, need for frequent monitoring, weekly for effectively 3 months, for both the initial infusions of bendamustine and then the dose ramp up of the venetoclax along with TLS monitoring. So, I think the community has gotten its sea legs under it. As far as that goes, but that may also be a factor. I hope that's also declining over time.
Is ICANS also related to tumor bulk?
It is. Certainly, the higher tumor burden patients are at high risk for both of those toxicities. And a major risk for ICANS is actually previously developing CRS. So tumor burden almost by definition impacts them both. It's pretty unusual to develop ICANS without any CRS preceding it. And oftentimes patients will develop their CRS. The CRS will crest and be getting better. And that's when the ICANS kicked in and the patient develops confusion. It's a bit of more of a delayed toxicity.
What about infectious complications of CAR T? Do you see more of that in CLL?
It's hard to say. I would say looking across the studies, infections are relatively common in CAR T-cell patients. These are heavily pretreated patients, especially CLL, 5 prior lines. We're going to see infections, whether they get chlorambucil or whether they get liso-cel. But there's no question, Neil, that among all the CAR T-cell studies, as you look further out, 2 years, 3 years, 4 years, there are still patients developing significant infections. And I think it's important that we as a community recognize that these are really immunocompromised patients, that the fludarabine and cyclophosphamide lymphodepletion really do burn out their lymphocytes for quite some time, particularly on a marrow that's been multiply pretreated. It's my personal practice to continue pneumocystis and antiviral prophylaxis. I monitor CD4 counts and don't discontinue it until their CD4 counts have rebounded to 200 or above. And I have plenty of patients who never rebound their CD4 count to 200 or above. So I think even in long-term follow-up, infection complications are expected, need to be recognized, need to consider opportunistic infections as risks in these patients, to remember CMV as a risk in these patients, remember the risks of COVID, of course, in this population. Remember there's an RSV vaccine that's going to be available for our patients in the fall, as well as the annual flu shot, hopefully the updated COVID-19 vaccine. And I would not be surprised if CLL patients were at more risk than other patients getting CAR T cells, because I think they're more innately immune suppressed before CAR T cell treatment.
That's interesting about the RSV vaccine. I kind of like when I heard about RSV, I think about kids. But is RSV an issue in these patients?
In immunocompromised patients, it definitely is. And the latest CDC guidance would say that for patients 60 years or older who are immunocompromised, that the RSV vaccine should be recommended. And our patients did have some very severe RSV infections last winter, which in an era where they could also get flu or COVID could lead to a real trifecta of a viral illness. So I don't believe that the CDC is recommending that vaccine for immunocompetent older adults, but for older adults who are immunocompromised, that is the recommendation that's coming down. And that is going to be, something that should be considered as early as September.
Interesting. What about bispecifics for CLL?
You know, there is some intriguing early data for epcoritamab, for example, in CLL. There's just a lot less of the data, a little bit using the odronextamab product as well. I'd love to see evidence with glofitamab and mosunetuzumab. But presently, the small amount of data we have is with epcoritamab and odronextamab. It appears to be effective, and the depth of remission might not be as deep as we're seeing in, say, follicular lymphoma or diffuse large B-cell lymphoma, but the numbers treated are small. And again, this post-BTK, post-venetoclax group of patients is still a really unmet medical need, where I'd love to see bispecifics more broadly studied as an off-the-shelf option for these patients. Notably, you know, the risk of CRS and neurotoxicity, though lower with bispecifics, do still happen. And perhaps similar to what we're seeing in this liso-cel study, is I'd expect the risks of CRS to be higher in a CLL patient with a high circulating tumor burden than, say, a follicular lymphoma patient. So we're going to, and it might require different dosing or dose escalation strategies. So I would encourage the manufacturers who are studying these products and developing these products to not forget about CLL as a treatment where bispecifics warrant investigation.
Sort of putting aside transform CLL, assuming they're not transformed, what's a clinical scenario where you would like to see, or you're sending a patient for CAR T now?
Well, right now we only have CAR T cell available on a clinical trial for CLL. And so that's the only context I would do it. But if I have a patient who's relapsed despite a BTK inhibitor and venetoclax, my number one question is there a CAR T cell trial I can put them on? I can tell you that liso-cel has been submitted to the FDA, and so the hope is that these Transcend CLL data will result in a label, because these patients really do represent an unmet medical need. And once available, if it does become FDA approved, that's who I'll think about it as well. A patient who's progressed despite a BTK inhibitor and a patient who's just progressed despite venetoclax.
So how are you going to think through pirtobrutinib versus CAR-T?
You know, I think pirtobrutinib is an absolutely reasonable option for those patients. And we can look at the Bruin data for pirtobrutinib in relapsed CLL. And what I would say is the depth of remission is not particularly deep, and the progression-free survival is not particularly long. As of today, if I don't have a CAR T cell trial available for that patient, then pirtobrutinib is definitely my next treatment of choice. But my impression from the Transcend CLL data is that we're seeing deeper remissions in patients receiving liso-cel than we might expect from pirtobrutinib. And so I'd prefer a CAR T cell if I had both available in my clinic. I will note that pirtobrutinib might also be a very appealing bridging therapy option if I was trying to get a CAR T cell available for that patient, but I needed some additional treatment. Pirto would be a terrific option as well.
That's interesting, though, your comments about the response to pirtobrutinib, because, you know, when you look at the waterfall plot, it looks so great, even for people who've had prior BTK. But you're saying that even in spite of that, the PFS is not as much, for example, as you see with first-line BTK untreated patients?
Yeah, that's correct. I mean, I think it's also, you know, these are often heavily resistant patients who are going on these studies. And so in the absence of a head-to-head trial, it's really impossible to say. But what we're typically not seeing, for example, is undetectable MRD. And if you recognize that in this study, 65% of patients are going MRD undetectable in the blood, that to me is a really remarkable statement on depth of response that I just don't think we're seeing with pirtobrutinib, but that pirtobrutinib can induce a durable response, even a durable PR in patients. So in the absence of CAR T cell therapy, pirtobrutinib is certainly my go-to option in those patients.
That's interesting, though, about MRD. I never thought to ask anybody, because obviously you don't see MRD with the BTK inhibitors that we have right now, but you're
correct.
Saying you also don't see it with pirtobrutinib.
That's correct. Very low levels.
Do you see these bispecifics being utilized in the community setting? You know, do these people have to go in the hospital? What's the difference between the bispecifics in that respect? But do you see this becoming part of a general medical oncology practice?
Yeah, I certainly do see it becoming part of a general medical practice. It's going to take a learning curve, not unlike venetoclax dose ramp up in CLL, and probably not unlike immune checkpoint inhibitors in nearly every solid tumor that's treated in the community, is a comfort level with identifying and managing the toxicity. The nice thing is that it's pretty predictable with these bispecific antibodies, even more so than with CAR T cells. Remember, unlike a CAR T cell, bispecific antibodies have a fixed half-life and they're injected, as opposed to a CAR T cell, which expands exponentially once it's infused. And so those are more of a delayed CRS risk and can be highly dependent on tumor burden. It's actually quite predictable. Mosunetuzumab does not require admission to the hospital. The CRS, if it occurs, occurs typically during that initial dose ramp-up. For epcoritamab, interestingly, which is a subcutaneously administered drug, it occurs on day 15, the third dose day of the dose ramp up, meaning the third week. And per the FDA label for epcoritamab in large cell lymphoma, hospitalization for observation should be considered after the day 15 dose. Although we and others have a study looking at pure outpatient dosing using prophylactic steroids. Glofitamab, the other major product approved for diffuse large B-cell lymphoma, also has a dose ramp up over the first 3 weeks, but the risk of CRS is highest after the first dose as opposed to the third dose. And so it's important to note that the incidence of onset of these toxicities varies based on the product. And based on that, the FDA label suggests a 24-hour period of observation after the first infusion of glofitamab. And so I think it's important for the docs in the community and all of us who use these drugs to really understand the differences among the products when the high-risk period is. And I think we're going to develop confidence over time to minimize the incidence of CRS and keep these patients outpatient.
I'm just kind of curious, let's say a doc wants to give mosunetuzumab. Do they need to have tocilizumab available?
You know, that is the party line, is to have it recommended, is to have it available. You know, in the real world setting, I'd say tocilizumab is rarely required with bispecific antibody treatment, particularly mosunetuzumab, where the incidence of severe CRS is extremely low. Again, this is not something that's exponentially expanding like a CAR T cell. It's unusual to see increasing grade of toxicity over time. Rather, you typically see it onset within hours and then decline within hours. And in general, in my practice, nearly all patients can be managed with corticosteroids alone. Grade 3 and higher toxicity with these products is extremely uncommon and usually turns around quite quickly with corticosteroids, but that is a patient where tocilizumab should be strongly considered. So while it's unlikely to be needed, I would say that that in the optimal interest of safety, that it should be available. You can also identify tumor burden, particularly the presence of leukemic phase disease, as risk factors for CRS. And so the highest risk patients are those with high tumor burden and leukemic phase disease, where I'd particularly want to keep a close eye on that patient and make sure that TOSI was available, even though it's unlikely to be needed.
I'm just kind of curious to what extent, if any, this would be an obstacle. For example, you have a general medical oncologist, they have maybe one or two people, they're going to use mosunetuzumab. I don't know how much of a hassle it is to get tocilizumab on your formulary. Do you think that would be an obstacle?
I think it is the way the current FDA labels are designed with the toxicity management algorithms, including tocilizumab. That's because the management algorithms on the studies included tocilizumab. What I really wish is that they didn't, and the TOSI was reserved for exceptional circumstances. But I think it was also in the interest of intervening as early as grade 2 to try and mitigate the toxicity profile. when in reality, minimizing the necessity for tocilizumab by just using corticosteroids might have made this a little easier to pitch as a community-based treatment program where toci didn't have to be in the freezer. So I think time will tell. I think some of the ongoing studies are really going to look at minimizing the use of tocilizumab, maximizing the use of prophylactic corticosteroids. And ultimately, I think we're going to see the treatment patterns evolve. And my prediction is that going forward, we will ultimately develop data that we don't really have to have toci available in the majority of patients, and that selected high-risk patients can be referred to centers where they might have toci on formulary.
Does it bother you at all to use corticosteroids in these patients in terms of the potentially impacting the mechanism of action of the drug?
You know, I don't particularly worry about it. We haven't seen a problem with CAR T cells, particularly if it's short-term impact. And particularly with these bispecific antibodies, you're usually looking at a few days. And unlike CAR T cells, where you've got this ongoing persistence and propagation where we taper corticosteroids over time, that usually is not necessary with bispecific antibodies. Once the toxicity passes, it passes.
Could you talk a little bit about why CD19 is the target of CAR T, but CD20 has been the target, at least of the initial bispecifics?
It's an interesting way the field has developed, and I think it's just how these compounds were designed and taken forward. CD19 certainly seemed very appealing as a CAR T cell target. It was previously a naive target. Patients hadn't received CD19 directed therapy. CD19 is a ubiquitously expressed target, including on ALL, B cell ALL. So it really targets a broad group of diseases. I don't know why the bispecifics really evolved primarily against CD20. I suppose that the bispecifics are sort of an evolution from the monospecific antibodies like rituximab and obinutuzumab, which also target CD20. So perhaps it's a natural extension to create a better CD20 targeted bispecific antibody. But practically, I think it's a nice thing that they're targeting different antigens, because if a patient loses one antigen, then they're still a candidate to target the alternate antigen. And ultimately, of course, there are studies with bispecific antibodies as well as CAR T cells targeting multiple antigens at the same time.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, do you think it's logical to actually look at the target prior to giving it? So looking to see if CD20 is there when you're given a bispecific, looking to see CD19s there. Do you do that for CAR T?
I do look for CD20, and the reason is patients have always had a CD20 treatment before. So if patients had, R-CHOP and then R-lenalidomide and they have a CD20 negative tumor, I'm going to be very unlikely to be enthusiastic about a CD20 directed treatment for that patient. Whereas I'd be very enthusiastic about a CD19-directed CAR T cell. And if a patient has not had a prior CD19-directed treatment, as most patients haven't, I do not check for CD19 because it is ubiquitously expressed. If a patient did receive a prior CD19-directed therapy, then I do check for CD19. Antigen density might matter. And so one wonders in the future if we're choosing between different targets, if we identify which antigen is most densely expressed and then target that antigen on a given patient, more personalized immunotherapy medicine for that patient. But that's a question for the future. I think right now, I'm not checking CD19, but I am checking CD20.
Just kind of curious where you are today in terms of first-line therapy in younger and older patients with mantle cell, sort of putting aside reimbursement issues, the regulatory issues, right now, what do you consider optimal therapy in those two situations?
Yeah, I think, upfront therapy is a moving target in my older patients, sort of the so-called non-transplant eligible population. There, I'm giving bendamustine and rituximab followed by rituximab maintenance. And reserving BTK inhibitors for patients with relapse refractory disease as a second-line treatment. The data for BR followed by rituximab really look excellent in that population, and it's encouraging to know that BTK inhibitors are available. Combining ibrutinib with bendamustine rituximab in the SHINE trial really led to excessive toxicity, which I think outweigh the benefit. And so I don't currently recommend the combination of BR ibrutinib in my older patients, nor is it included as an NCCN guideline recommendation. Now, older patients is a bit of a different story. Here, we've typically used rituximab and cytarabine-based induction therapy, followed by high-dose chemotherapy and autotransplant, followed by maintenance rituximab. The TRIANGLE trial, which was presented in the plenary session at the last American Society of Hematology meeting, looked at a three-arm trial, which used an RDHAP alternating with R-CHOP induction regimen, followed by autologous stem cell transplant as the standard comparator arm, with rituximab maintenance being added at the time that it was approved in the participating European countries. The two experimental arms added ibrutinib during induction along with the R-CHOP and in maintenance after completion of induction for a total of 2 years, with one of the two experimental arms still having an autologous stem cell transplant and the other not having an autotransplant and just having maintenance rituximab and ibrutinib. What that study basically showed is regarding the induction regimen, that the ibrutinib clearly improved progression-free survival when compared to R-CHOP, R-DHAP alone. The second question in that study is really the role of the transplant. And while the maturity data are not yet there for the transplant versus maintenance rituximab question, those curves were directly overlapping, meaning there was no obvious benefit for transplant in a patient who's receiving ibrutinib and rituximab maintenance. How do I put that together today in my young transplant-eligible patients? I do find that data compelling, and there's also a trend, though not yet statistically significant, in favor of overall survival for inclusion of ibrutinib in the initial treatment. I'd also note that unlike the SHINE trial in older patients, the added toxicity of ibrutinib in these younger patients was much less, particularly in patients who didn't go to autotransplant. So what do I now consider in my young transplant-eligible patients? I consider induction therapy with either the R-CHOP or DHAP regimen, where the ibrutinib is included with the R-CHOP, not included with the R-DHAP regimen, then followed by maintenance rituximab and maintenance ibrutinib, and without a transplant. So my current practice, based on those data, is if I'm including ibrutinib, I no longer take those patients to transplant. If I'm not giving those patients ibrutinib, they're not an ibrutinib candidate, they have a bleeding diathesis, and I want to avoid that, I'll still do my typical previous approach, which is intensive induction therapy followed by maintenance rituximab. But I do think ibrutinib substantially improved outcomes in these young patients, and that transplant did not in the modern era. And so to me, that data is indeed practice changing.
And if you could, would you substitute Acala or Zanu for the ibrutinib?
You know, that's a question has been asked frequently. I personally am a slight bit of a purist in that I would not in that regard. Short of any data for those drugs in this particular category. There's no data for maintenance zanubrutinib or maintenance acalabrutinib in mantle cell lymphoma. There's no data combining with induction therapy in mantle cell lymphoma. So it would really be substituting those drugs without direct data. So I personally would not do that. I would follow the study. However, if I started a patient on, say, ibrutinib-based therapy and they had intolerance to ibrutinib, I would feel very comfortable swapping out the ibrutinib for one of the drugs due to intolerance if I found that were the case. And that's because in every other indication where we use ibrutinib and other BTK inhibitors, we found the ability to substitute a next-generation BTK inhibitor and usually be able to do that without recrudescence of the toxicity. So I'll start with ibrutinib, but I'll certainly replace it with a different agent if the ibrutinib is poorly tolerated.
So one final question, getting back to your older patient, would you bring up the possibility of a Acala R? Do you think it's a better quality of life? I know there's very few patients there in terms of tolerability or complications, but do you think the quality, in terms of efficacy, do you think the quality of life would be better on the Acala rituximab than BR?
No, I think it's hard to say. You know, bendamustine rituximab is generally well-tolerated treatment as well. And for patients who we really want to avoid chemotherapy, we do have an option in that space, which is lenalidomide rituximab. So right now, with just such a small study with limited follow-up, I would not currently make that, but I do consider lenalidomide rituximab as an option for patients who I really want to avoid the benda. I feel very comfortable knowing that I've got these next generation BTK inhibitors available as a second line treatment. Ultimately, though, if we were to be looking into the future, I predict chemotherapy is going away in those patients. I think we will be using next generation BTK inhibitors as initial treatment for older patients with mantle cell, potentially with just a CD20 antibody, potentially with venetoclax. There's some appealing data being generated right now. But presently, with the status of the current data, I wouldn't just yet.
So, you know, there's one more question I have to ask you about Hodgkin lymphoma. Try to guess what it is.
Oh, golly. Is it whether we still need to be transplanting these patients? Or
no, it's like, what's your first line therapy?
Yeah. So the first line therapy for advanced stage is clearly going to be Nivo AVD based on that trial. It's better efficacy, and in my opinion, it's better safety, and it doesn't cause the neuropathy, which is such a limiting factor in the with the brentuximab regimen. Would I do it today? I think it's hard to recommend a regimen today that has not yet been published in a peer-reviewed journal and has not been added to an NCCN guideline or been given an FDA label. So without any of those three things, I think it's poised to become the new standard of care. But I think we probably do need to see either a peer-reviewed manuscript to get a little into the weeds on the data, although I'm confident I don't question the results. And for regulatory reasons, I think it may not get paid for unless there's an NCCN guideline indication or an FDA label. So I'd say today, if I could give it, I would. As a new standard of care, I am convinced it's better than brentuximab AVD. Definitely better tolerated than brentuximab AVD as of today.
And do you see 2, 3, 4, 5 years down the line a role for brentuximab in the upfront setting?
You know, I think that's a really interesting question. I think, you know, both of these regimens, brentuximab AVD and Nivo AVD, omitted bleomycin. They both still contain vinblastine. And of course, the reason there's so much toxicity when you give brentuximab AVD is the overlapping toxicity of two microtubule inhibitors. And so I think a real question going forward is, can we get rid of the vinblastine and actually use brentuximab instead? It's much more myelo-friendly. It doesn't cause the same degree of cytopenias as vinblastine, which is quite myelotoxic, and it would allow a more targeted approach. So we're looking right now at a study in limited stage, as well as advanced stage Hodgkin's, looking at brentuximab AD Nivo, adding nivolumab, brentuximab to adriamycin dacarbazine. And that's a way to omit both the bleomycin and the vinblastine. And in the case of limited stage Hodgkin's, the radiation as well. I'd love to see that regimen move forward. And I think if I were to pick an ideal next randomized trial for the intergroup, it would be to take Nivo AVD and compare it to brentuximab AD nivolumab, only use two chemotherapy drugs, adriamycin and dacarbazine, omit vinblastine and the bleomycin, and incorporate both of our best targeted agents up front.
So one final question, which is, we've known for a long time that Hodgkin lymphoma is uniquely sensitive to checkpoint inhibitors. They have this amplification of the PD-1. Clinically, we saw benefit. I mean, there's like a million checkpoint inhibitor trials in solid tumors. I mean, like some phase 3, I mean, like, unbelievable, bladder, everything. Mm-hmm. Why did it take so long to get a trial looking at IO in the first line Hodgkin lymphoma?
That's a great question, Neil. You know, I think there are several reasons. In Hodgkin lymphoma, where you cure so many patients, I think there's hasn't been a tremendous appetite to do large scale trials until we had such highly effective agents available, such as the checkpoint inhibitors and brentuximab. Since ABVD historically has worked so very well in that patient population, there's also, I think, some initial concern that if you combine the immune checkpoint inhibitor with chemotherapy, that you're effectively going to negate the effect of the checkpoint inhibitor by combining with chemotherapy, because the chemotherapy will be targeting the effector cells that you need to attack the tumor once you take the brakes off the immune system. Ultimately, however, you know, I think we've learned that you can combine chemotherapy with immune checkpoint inhibitors. I'll note the same argument was made when it was the question whether we should add rituximab to CHOP. Will a monoclonal antibody add to chemotherapy, or will we just be negating the effect of immunotherapy? So I think those are the reasons why it took a while to get here, but I'm glad we're here, and I think we've still got room to go. Ideally, further trim down the chemotherapy, potentially even trim down the number of cycles. Do we really need to be giving 6 cycles to all of these patients? I'd love to see if we can give early interim PET CR patients as few as 4 cycles. So I think we move in baby steps in Hodgkin's because we want to make sure we maintain the high cure rate. But there's still room to improve safety and even efficacy, it turns out, when we incorporate these novel agents.
Yeah, I mean, hazard rate was close to 0.5 there. I mean, that's pretty good
efficacy. Pretty impressive.
This concludes our program. Special thanks to Dr. Abramson, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for Oncology Today.